Well, Saja has prayed for us as we've heard the scriptures. It was great to hear the beginning of this unfolding dramatic story in Genesis 24. We'll hear that over the next few weeks. But we're jumping back into Luke's gospel too, so let's do that. And as we do, let me ask you, when was the last time you declined an invitation? When was the last time you declined an invitation? We all have to do that at times. We have to decline invitations sometimes. We often just ignore them if you're like I do with Facebook and things. They come through and you ignore them. Or also, like I do, you might say to people sometimes when they invite you, oh, maybe, and then you forget to decide and you forget to get back. That happens. By the way, I know that's not just me because I discovered in the research for this sermon that there are whole web pages dedicated to telling you how to say maybe to an invitation. So there you go. But there are some invitations you don't decline, aren't there? Like if you got an invitation to tea with the king, you wouldn't decline that, would you? You may be able to think of other invitations that you would never decline. What would it be for you? An invitation that if you got it, you would never decline it. Well, imagine you got sent an invitation and you saw it. Maybe it was a paper invitation. Maybe it was in your inbox. You saw it, but you didn't really take notice, didn't really take it seriously. And so you declined it without really thinking about it, or you ignored it and forgot about it, and then the time passed, only to find out too late that you missed the event that you would never want to decline. You missed something you'd always wanted to be part of, something, in fact, that you really needed to be a part of. You missed it because you didn't take the invitation seriously. Well, our passage today warns us about falling into something very much like that. So make sure you don't miss the significance of this passage. It's worth having it open if you've got a Bible there or on your phone. Luke chapter 14, beginning of verse 1. Looking at the first two-thirds of that chapter today. But in order to understand it, we need some context. It's a while since we've been in the Gospel of Luke. Some of you may not have even been here when we were looking at this great gospel. So as we jump back into it, let's briefly remember the big picture of Luke, first of all. Luke tells us what he's doing in his gospel right at the start of the gospel. Keep moving, is that thing going? There we go. He tells us what he's doing right at the start of the gospel. In his opening words, he says he's writing an orderly account to give certainty about the message of Jesus. These are the very first words of the gospel, that's what he says. And he can give that certainty because he has access to the testimony of eyewitnesses, those who saw and knew Jesus, whom he's writing about. So it's this message, this story of Jesus that he's gotten from the eyewitnesses, which we're looking at in Luke's gospel as we read Luke's gospel. That's the big picture of the gospel. If we zoom in one step and kind of focus in one step from there, and we look at just the big picture within the big picture, just the big picture, we're in a section of Luke's gospel, a big section, where Jesus is on a journey. That's why we've called this series A Certain Journey. He's on a journey from chapters 9 all the way to chapter 19. And we're in chapter 14, right in the middle. He's been on this journey, as I say, since chapter 9. And in chapter 9, he spoke of his need to be rejected and to suffer. He said, I need to do that. I must do that. And then after he said that, he set out for Jerusalem, where it was all going to happen. Well, we're right in the middle of the journey. And over the next few months, with a couple of little breaks in between, over the next few months, we're going to follow Jesus all the way to Jerusalem in chapter 19. We're going to be following him as he heads towards Jerusalem until he gets there. That's the big picture of this journey to Jerusalem that Jesus is on, that we're on with him now. And it was during that journey that the events happened, which we heard today from the first two-thirds of chapter 14, with this warning about declining an important invitation. This passage in chapter 14 that we're looking at is in three parts. There's a healing trap, advice for guests and hosts, and then a vital invitation. We're going to focus on the last of those three, on the invitation part in this very big and rich passage. But very quickly, we'll touch on the first two now. And there's a lot going on here as we jump back into Luke because it's just part of getting back into it. But stay with me. We're going to quickly focus on the first two, a healing trap, advice for guests and hosts, and then we're going to sort of lock in on the last one about the invitation. So, firstly, a healing trap. That's verses 1 to 6. Jesus has been invited to eat with a prominent Pharisee, it says in verse 1. Literally, it's one of the rulers of the Pharisees. So this is an important person who's invited Jesus to his house on a Sabbath to eat. And then in verse 2, suddenly this other person appears, this guy with a terrible swelling problem. And this is much like a number of other healings in the Gospel of Luke, especially one we saw in chapter 13 last year, which was also on a Sabbath, which is the Jewish day of rest. And like this one, it caused controversy. But here in chapter 14, this was almost certainly a kind of trap. You notice it says in verse 1, Jesus was being carefully watched. Now, literally, it's they were watching him closely. The Pharisees, the host's people, were watching Jesus very carefully, looking to catch him out, which they've been doing for a while now, the Pharisees, looking to catch Jesus out. But in the face of that, he shows them why it's perfectly right for him to heal this man, even on the Sabbath, and he does heal him. He shows compassion to the suffering man in the face of those who are trying to trap him, and he sets him free from his suffering. These Pharisees have been watching, trying to catch him, but now he spins the things around and he goes on the offensive. In a very typical Jesus way, he goes on the offensive with some advice. And it's offensive advice, actually. Advice for guests and hosts, as you'll see. First of all, he gives this advice for guests. Literally in verse 7, he notices that the guests are kind of looking for the best seats. Literally, the guests is those who are called. Those who are invited, called. And that's going to be important because this language of called comes up a number of times. Those who are called, he says. He says, when you're those called to a dinner party, stop trying to secure the top spots. See, they want the best seats. They want the seats of honor. They want the top of the table. They want the head table. But Jesus says to them, don't do that. Stop trying to promote yourself by putting yourself in the best place. Don't seek to get honor by having the honored place. Instead, let other people worry about the honoring. You take a humble seat. Take a low seat. Let other people worry about who's going to be honored. He sums it up with that really important saying in verse 11. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. And that's a bigger theme in the Gospel of Luke. We'll see more of it later in this series. We're at the same. He says exactly the same thing again, which you know it's important when Jesus says something more than once. And we'll see it's ultimately about being humble before God, as is only right, because he's God and we're not, and leaving the honoring up to him. Yes, being humble before people, leaving the honoring up to others, and ultimately you do that because you're humble before God and you're leaving the honoring up to him. We just take our place of humility before God and leave it up to him to honor whoever he wants to. So that's Jesus' advice to the guests. But notice, it's pretty direct and uncomfortable. What are these guests, these people who are called, what are they doing at this party? Well, they're doing the exact opposite of this. They're trying to grab the places of honor. And he says, don't do that. That's not the right thing to do. This is a serious, uncomfortable challenge. Pretty awkward. And then he follows up with some more awkward advice for the hosts. Indeed, in verse 12, he speaks directly to his host. The one who invited him, the one who called him and the other guests to the dinner party. And he says, don't invite the obvious people to your dinner parties, to your get-togethers. Don't invite your family. Don't invite your rich neighbors. Above all, don't invite people who are going to invite you back. Because if you do that, you're really inviting them for yourself, aren't you? Because you want them there, you enjoy their company, so I'm going to invite you. And they're going to invite me back and honor me, so I'm going to invite them. It's about yourself. And he says, don't do it for that reason. Rather, care for those in need, the poor, the crippled, the blind, the lame, those whom God cares for, but who can't do anything for you. Don't invite strategically so you can get the most out of your invitations. Invite compassionately, graciously, self-givingly. Again, in some sense, this advice is a challenge to the practice of promoting yourself. But in this case, it's using invitations to promote yourself, because you invite them, then they'll invite you and you'll get honored and all that. No, he's saying, don't do that. Invite those who can do nothing for you. and leave the rewarding up to God. He will reward rightly. There's another challenge. And again, imagine how uncomfortable this would have been. He's speaking to the host who invited him. Presumably, this host hasn't invited the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind. But Jesus says this to him. Now, we've moved through a lot very quickly there. How are you going? You're staying with me? You're holding on? Very good. Because it's from there we get up to the part of the passage that we're going to focus in on today. We're going to slow down a little bit and look at. So from verses 15 to 24, a vital invitation. A vital invitation. This kicks off with an interjection. Jesus has been speaking, and then one of the guests at the party jumps in. You kind of get the feeling he maybe felt how awkward things were getting with Jesus giving this uncompromising, challenging advice. And so he kind of jumps in, and he sort of agrees with Jesus, but also seems to be trying to change the subject. So verse 15, he says, "Blessed is the one who will eat at the feast in the kingdom of God." Yes, Jesus, he's saying, God will surely reward people at the resurrection of the righteous, just like you said, at the great feast of the kingdom. Won't that be fantastic? Now let's move on. Now, the great feast or banquet of the kingdom was a well-known image of hope for the Jewish people, that they had this image of the time when God would return and restore all things into their proper place and bring abundance and be great feasting. And the man's basically saying, it'll be great, won't it, when we're there? All of us, Jesus, we'll all be there. It'll be great. Well, it's a dangerous thing to try to change the subject on Jesus or to try to placate him and make him less challenging. And so Jesus replies. And he replies with a story, with a parable, as he often does. And as so often, this one has a sting in it. He starts by picking up that idea of the great banquet that the man had just spoken about. So immediately, we're thinking here, this is in some way a picture of the banquet in God's kingdom that Jesus is painting for us here. And he begins with verse 16. "A certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests." So the invites have gone out in advance for this great banquet. Literally, people have been called to come. When it says invited many guests, he's called many guests to come. And according to the custom of the time, a confirmation, you'd send out the initial invitations, and then a confirmation would be sent out when everything's ready and it was time to make your way to the feast. So it's almost like you're waiting in the lounge room waiting for the dinner to be ready, almost like that, but you weren't in the lounge room, you were somewhere else, and you were expecting someone to come and tell you when it's time to come to the feast because everything's ready. Now, at this point, everything's as you would expect it for a feast at that time. And then things go horribly wrong because the invitation is declined. The servant goes out to tell the guests it's now time to come. And one by one they decline. As verse 18 says, they make excuses. So, verse 18, the first one. And they all like began to make excuses. The first said, "I've just bought a field and I must go and see it. Please excuse me. I've bought some land. I have to go see it right now. Can't come. Sorry." Verse 19, the second guest. Another said, "I've just bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me. So I bought some cattle, 10 in fact, 5 pairs. I need to check that they are in good working order, so please give my apologies. I've got to go and do it right now." Verse 20, still another said, "I just got married, I can't come." Excuses, excuses. One excuse after another for not coming to the banquet, to the great feast. And there's one commentator who sums up what's happening here like this, and I think it's helpful. He says, "Imagine a contemporary Western scene in which the guests arrive and are seated in the living room, and when the food is ready, the hostess invites the guests to take their places, but to the shock of all, they offer excuses and head for the door. One says, 'I have to mow the lawn.' The second blurts out, 'I must feed the cat.' The third says, 'There are bills on my desk waiting to be paid.' And the three walk out the door. Or you could substitute in there, 'I have to wash my hair,' or anything like that. It's a shocking thing to give excuses and not come when you've been cordially and generously invited by a great master of the banquet." And we might think these excuses just do sound a bit silly. And yet, are they so silly? When you think about it, they represent three things that we would all consider very important things in life. Verse 18, I've bought a field. Well, that's property and possessions, important part of life. Verse 19, I've bought some oxen, something that he'd be using in his field, in his work. This is a work, a career, a business excuse. I'm very busy with my work. I've got to go do work things. Verse 20, I got married. This is family and romantic relationship. Family first, after all. In many ways, these are actually very understandable excuses. They are important things in life. Indeed, they're things that we often give as excuses for declining Jesus or for not making him and his kingdom a high priority, a top priority in our lives. And for those of us who are Christians who have, in a sense, accepted Jesus' invitation to us, we still often act and prioritize as if his invitation isn't so important. At times, with property and possessions. Do we make acquisitions and tending to our house or our batch or something like that a reason, for instance, to easily miss church? Because church isn't just a club, it's a kingdom gathering. It's something we do as part of the kingdom. So do we make things that we have an excuse to easily miss church? I know sometimes we feel like we have to do that with a house or something like that, but does it even bother us? Do we feel uncomfortable when we miss church because of something like that? At a previous church I was at, one of the ministers told me he'd noticed a pattern with people who bought boats. Now, nothing against boats, I'll say in a second, but the pattern's helpful to see. They would decide to buy a boat. Big decision, usually a lot of money, and that's not wrong, but they'd think how to buy a boat. But once they bought the boat, they'd say, well, I've put all this money into the boat. I have to use it now, and with sport and everything, Sunday morning's the only time I've got. I'll just have to miss church most of the time this summer. Maybe just once or twice for a start, but then more and more and more. See, I have to use the boat. And Jesus' priorities get pushed out. And even there'd be things like, well, I know it's a really valuable time at Easter for the gospel and for inviting people. And if I'm realistic, some of my friends at work, that'd be the most likely time they would have to come to church. But it's a long weekend and I've got a boat. So I've got to use the boat. So I can't come to church. And on it goes with the kingdom priorities getting pushed aside because of property and possessions. Not wrong in themselves, but they become an excuse for pushing Jesus back. What about work? Oh, by the way, I should say it may not be boats for you. but what is it? It'll be something for all of us. Things for me. What about work? What about career? Do we let work push in on church really easily or on, say, well, growth group isn't that important because work's really, really busy. It is. But are you thinking, this is a kingdom thing? I've got this opportunity to talk, to meet up with this friend, and I know this friend's kind of interested in Christianity, but work's just too busy. And if I don't prioritize work, I might get behind in my career or my business might suffer. Or in a different way, I know I won't advance in my career or amongst my studies or with my fellow students if I'm too obviously Christian. So I'll just never say anything about it. It's private, after all. I wouldn't want it to hinder my career. What about family and romantic relationships? This is the toughest one for us often, I think. Do we miss youth group or church or growth group without even a second thought because there's a family occasion? Well, I wonder if you consider delaying a family get-together or a celebration to a different day to avoid clashing with kingdom commitments. Or do you just think, no, family first? It's not family first. It's kingdom of God first for all of us. On the romance side, do we put our attractions to someone ahead of our commitment to Jesus? It's really hard stuff, isn't it? Something we really care about. But does Jesus come second to them? I know this is tough stuff. But Jesus tends to challenge us like that. He tends to speak not just up here, but into the depths of our hearts. He knows the things that are difficult for us, and he speaks to them. And he warns about declining his invitation for things that matter. But actually, he matters more. And there might be some here, though, who've never accepted Jesus' invitation in the first place. If that is you, I'm so glad you're here. It is wonderful. This is a good place for you to be this morning. But I do want you to hear the warning in what Jesus is saying here, because he warns us all for our own good. These areas are real dangers for declining his invitation completely. And this is an invitation you don't want to miss. Property and possessions, very similar to what I already said, for Christians, these can be reasons people don't even take Jesus seriously at all in the first place. I can't go to church. I can't spend time looking into him. I've got to live my life. I've got a batch to spend time on. I've got a caravan to go away, and I've got a boat to use. I've got drum kit to play, whatever it is. I've got no time because I have to live my life and use my stuff. But who gave you this life that you need to live? Who gave it to you? Do you want to so easily ignore him? Or career. I couldn't take Jesus seriously because it might impact my career, and that's very important to me. I might be looked down on by my fellow workers or my peers in business or by my other students at school or at tertiary study or whatever it is. I heard recently of someone who had to write a project in a course they were doing, and they wrote about Jesus. And the course they were doing and the subject of the project, it was seems appropriate to write about Jesus. He fitted into the thing. But they were told, don't talk about stuff like that in this business if you want to get ahead. I wonder if you might feel that pressure. And therefore, not even look into Jesus. Because what if he was true and it gets in the way? Or family. Again, this is, I think, the biggest one for many of us. What if I looked into this Jesus thing? What if I really listened to Jesus? What if I really opened my heart to the possibility he might be the Lord? I might need to take him seriously. And what if I found out it was true and some of my family didn't like it? What if my boyfriend or my girlfriend or my husband or my wife didn't like it? What if they really don't like Christianity? Or what if they would see it as if I'd rejected them because I chose Jesus? I might not see it that way. Maybe it wouldn't be that way, but what if they saw it that way? It's really hard, isn't it? But in the end, no matter what anyone else thinks, you will still have to stand before Jesus one day. We all will, because he promised that. And we won't be able to use family as an excuse for declining his invitation. After all, he's the one who gave us the people around us. He's the one who gave us the people who are most precious to us. So we can't use them as an excuse for declining him. This is a deeply challenging parable that Jesus tells. He exposes our excuses. He certainly exposed mine through this week. Has he exposed yours this morning? But, even there, the parable continues. And it continues with a broad invite. Because verse 21, when the master hears of the excuses being made, he is very angry at the slap in the face that these people are giving him by declining his invitation like this. But it doesn't lead him to cancel the party, to throw his toys out of the cot and say, well, just call it off then. It doesn't lead him to just stay home and keep all those good things to himself. What he does instead is he broadens his invitation. He sends his servant out into the streets and the alleys of the town, verse 21, to invite the poor and the crippled and the blind and the lame, the people that Jesus said you're supposed to invite to things, right? But even when these have come in to the house, it's not enough. So verse 23, he sends the people out of the town, because that was he sent them into the streets of the town, first of all, he sends them out of the town, into the country. Even country people are invited. And he invites people from there. And he says, compel them. Those further away, he says, compel them. Bring them in. I want my house full. Welcome them all. And that reflects something else so important. When we hear this hard challenge of Jesus, we need to see this. The invitation that Jesus makes, that God makes through Jesus, is open to all. Whether you are near or far, you're invited. No matter how unlikely you think it might be for Jesus to invite you, it is precisely you that he invites. The poor and the blind and the crippled and the lame didn't usually get invites to dinner parties in those days, but Jesus is no ordinary host. So if you're a person here this morning, he invites you to the great banquet of God's kingdom. No matter who you are, no matter what you've done, no matter what your background is, no matter how you identify, no matter how far from him you think you might be, he invites you. And to accept his invitation, you simply accept him. You trust in him. You say, yes, I want to follow you, Jesus. I want to accept your invitation to this kingdom. If you want to know more about that, I'd love to talk to you about it afterwards. Or flick me an email or a text. My details are in the service sheets. But the story doesn't quite end there either. Because Jesus finishes by emphasizing one more thing. He emphasizes the danger of declining. Verse 24. He says, I tell you, not one of those who are invited will get a taste of my banquet. Those who are invited, those who were called and made excuses and refused to come, they won't get in. Now, this was a powerful challenge at the time Jesus spoke this, because, again, that word there for those invited is literally those called, and that's the same language that's used to describe the guests who were at the party in verse 7, the party that he told the story at. The people who were there were those who were called. And he says, those who were called, they won't get a taste of the banquet. The people who were already at this party, who were they? They were the friends of the religious guy. In other words, they were the religious people. They were the people who already thought they were on the inside with God. And yet, they were also people who were trying to trap Jesus. They were very religious, but they weren't accepting Jesus. There's a great challenge here, because he says, they won't get a taste of my banquet. There's a great warning to them. They're in huge danger in all their religion and all their rightness of declining the one who they need to save them, the only one who can let them into the banquet of God. So let me finish by asking you, are you in danger of declining Jesus? He makes this invitation to us, to each of us, an invitation to the kingdom of God and to the great banquet of the kingdom. It's a broad invitation. He makes the invitation to you. Don't miss it. Don't casually decline him and thereby miss the greatest invite. In the end, this will be the one invitation that you do not want to decline. Because being outside this party is not where you want to be. And the only way to accept it, the only way in, is to accept Jesus. He calls you. Will you accept his invitation? Let's pray. Great God, we do give you great thanks for the wonderful invitation, the broad invitation to the great